Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. We are currently studying the book of Genesis, so open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Tonight, Tom and I had dinner with Andrew and Lee, who came up from the Atlanta area, and Lee said that he had been speaking to his son, Trey, and that Trey was hoping at some point during the message that Lee would send a shout out to Trey. So let's get this out of the way. Everybody, shout out to Trey.
What's up, Trey?
Hi, Trey!
What's up?
Yo, Trey!
Call me.
I have no explanation for that.
It's so genetic. That's what it is.
I know. That's what it is. That's why I can't get upset. You can just see the genetics at work.
Exactly.
There, we got that out of the way. We're in Genesis 10. In Genesis 10, as we saw last week, Moses, speaking from the point of view, the advantageous point of view of already knowing the history that he was writing about, gave us a defense of the idea that all the people groups on the planet are represented in the eight people that were on the ark, which makes sense if, in fact, everybody was wiped out in the flood and there were only eight people on the boat. Then it makes sense that every people group on the planet would have to be represented somewhere in those original eight people. And so between the three sons, Shem and Ham and Japheth, Moses went on to describe their lineages and the different areas that they were scattered into. But he was speaking, like I said, from the advantage of already knowing how those people groups were going to be separated and divided out. It was always God's determination to divide people up and separate people out. In chapter 10, verse 25, we read past it last week. Tonight, we're going to use it as a jumping off point. Chapter 10, verse 25 says, "And unto Eber were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg." Now, you'll notice that most of the names that are mentioned in this chapter, there's no description of what the name means or why it's significant. But in the case of Peleg, he actually takes the time to say, "The name of one was Peleg, for in his days was the earth divided." And so it was God's intention, even in naming these children, to point out, and Moses picks it up and points it out, that it was God's determination to divide people up. And that is why the Tower of Babel story follows right on the heels of the lineages of Shem and Ham and Japheth. The two cannot be disconnected, despite the fact that there's a big 11 right in the middle of the story, which gives us the impression that a new idea is starting, that a new chapter has begun, and that we're supposed to read it as some kind of separate idea. But in Moses' original writing, he went right from verse 32, "These are the families of the sons of Noah, after their generations in their nations, and by these were the nations divided in the earth after the flood," and, see the next word? He's continuing in chapter 11, verse 1, to explain how it is that the nations were divided on the earth. It was always God's intention to divide nations on the earth. Look back at verse 8 of chapter 10. "And Cush," that name later becomes the area we now know as Ethiopia, "Cush begot Nimrod, and he began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel." And so we are prepared at that point between that information about God determining to divide the nations and the kingdom of Babel being developed by Nimrod. We're then prepared to go charging into chapter 11. The original Chaldean word Babel actually means gate of God. Anybody in here familiar with the Baha'i religion? The followers of the Baha'u'llah? There are some very famous Baha'is. Seals and Croft. Anybody remember Seals and Croft? Diamond Girl, sing it, Lee. Yeah, I knew he would. Seals and Croft, Baha'i folks. And in their concerts, they would hand out Baha'i literature. I used to record up at Dawnbreaker Studios, which was their studio. And so I was inundated with Baha'i material by their entire group. And they said, well, if you're a Christian, then you want to know the whole story of Christianity. You want to know the completion of Christianity, which would take you to the Baha'u'llah, which means the glory of God. You hear the name Allah right in there, right? The Baha'u'llah in the 18th century, well, 1800s, 19th century, was supposedly the reincarnation, the next incarnation of Christ. Except that he lived the majority of his life in prison in Persia. Not exactly the way Christ is predicted to come back as Lord of Lords and King of Kings. But while he was here in this next incarnation as the Baha'u'llah, he explained that earlier generations of men were just so ignorant that they weren't able to hear or perceive the whole truth. And so he had come to give us the rest of the truth. Things like hell doesn't exist. That whole concept of hell was something that earlier generations of men who were quite sinful needed to be told in order to keep them in line. But now, as we have progressed and grown spiritually, we have reached that point of spiritual maturity and development where we can be told the truth that hell was just a whipping rod that God used before to keep people in line. Well, anyway, the point of bringing up the Baha'i faith is that there was a predecessor, a John the Baptist-type predecessor to the Baha'u'llah, and if you read the history of Baha'i, you'll read a lot about the Bab, and it's B-A-B, just like this. He is the gate. He was the one who came to say that the Baha'u'llah was coming. I just always found it humorous that in the Baha'i religion, the guy who paved the way was Bob. I mean, that's just humorous. I can't help it. Gate. So the original name for Babel is Gate of God, or entrance way into God. Later, as the word moved through the Hebrew and it became the form we're familiar with now, Babel, which sounds like, when it's pronounced, a Hebrew word written in English letters here that actually means confusion. And so it is the place where God confused the people by confusing their languages for the purpose of spreading people out all over the planet. As long as people were all of one language and basically one mind, they could all cooperate as a group. The problem is, whenever human beings all cooperate as a group, they don't generally do good things. And as we've seen so far, ever since the fall, all the imaginations of man's heart is only continuously evil. We don't see people after the fall doing progressively better things. We don't see God approving of them on grander and grander levels. Instead, what we see is this progressive downhill slide until God says, well, that's it, I'll just kill everybody. Keeps eight alive, starts again, but because these are, after all, the sons of Adam, they start right downhill again, and the descendants of Ham through Canaan are cursed right away. And so it's not like you see progressive goodness. So all of mankind is now in this area that is today Iraq, basically, which is why Iraq is often referred to as the cradle of civilization. This is the first place that cultures, societies develop. Now, one of the things that archaeologists...
Careful.
You could see it in my eyes, couldn't you? One of the things that has fascinated archaeologists for years is that certain things about human culture are really genuinely inexplicable, in that things like language, for instance, written language, doesn't have years and years of progressive development. We don't find very early forms of writing that only had two letters, and then eventually three. Hey, now we're getting some words going. Instead, language appears on the stage of history in very complex forms, amazingly complex forms. And of course, in the Bible, no sooner does God create Adam than he begins conversing with him, starts communicating with him, unlike he does any other creature he makes. God did not make kangaroos and have a conversation, but he made Adam and right away begins communicating with him through language. Culture, societal culture, the mores that make up cooperative living, one of the most fascinating parts of human development, and one of the things that the Darwinists just cannot explain, is why or how humans developed culture, because historically we find all this evidence of very complete, complex cultures, but you don't find beginnings, you don't find development, you just find culture. And that's much more like the way the Bible describes it, that whether it was God giving language to men, or whether it was, as we read several weeks ago, this hybrid of very intelligent, eternal, fallen beings cohabiting with women and then teaching them great amounts of knowledge they would otherwise have never had contact with, we can understand the world from a biblical standpoint much easier than the archaeologist or the people who believe in Darwinism can understand the world. We can see the hand of a maker. We can see the hand of a creator and say, well, yes, there it is again. We see more evidence yet again of a creator in ways that the Darwinists just can't explain. We have an explanation for it, which is that there is wisdom behind the creation itself, and that that wisdom was able to infuse similar wisdom right into creatures so that man could be created and then communicate, have that capacity for communication fully developed. Well, then that same God is fully capable, I said all that to say this, that same God is very capable of taking that ability he has given to human beings, the ability to communicate and use language, and use that as a tool to separate people, divide people, and create people groups according to his own design. This is the same God, by the way, who shows up in the beginning of the book of Acts on the day of Pentecost and utilizes language. And Peter speaks, and all these people from all these different areas and regions all hear in their own language, in their own tongue. So God has always been in control of language and has demonstrated again and again that language is a godly characteristic. It's something that God does. God communicates. God wants to communicate with his creatures. God wants to communicate with people, and so he gave us the method, the mode to do that. He gave us language. But he controls language, and he divides language. He makes us understand language. Some people have the ability to speak several languages. I don't. I am dramatically monolinguistic. I mean, I speak one language. And other people walk around with 7, 8 languages going on in their head. Well, that's a gift. That's an ability God gave them. And language is a tool that God uses to communicate with us. This is why, by the way, since I talk about Christianity so often as being a revealed religion, what I mean by that is there are folks who think that if they sit on the seashore and watch the waves roll in or hug a tree long enough, that they are going to commune with nature and godliness to a degree where they can learn to appreciate God through his creation. And that's all fine. It's nice to appreciate pretty things, but you can't learn anything really important about God unless it is communicated to you. Faith comes by hearing. And hearing by the word of God. This is the way that God determined, of the infinite choices I suppose he had. I'm sure that he could have just done telekinetic communication if he had chosen to. But he decided that communication via language was the tool and the method he was going to use to produce faith in people. And so he gave people a capacity he simply didn't give any other creature, the ability to communicate in languages that God uses. And so he's going to use that same godlike capacity, that same characteristic, to control language, to divide human beings. And he's going to divide human beings on purpose, because ever since Peleg was named, it was God's determination to divide. So it's easy to read the Tower of Babel story and get the impression that God was forced to react to people because people did bad things and built a tower, and God said, oh, well, that's it, I'm fed up with this, I think I'll divide their languages. The reason that Peleg is mentioned in there is because it was God's determination he was going to divide the nations. The Tower of Babel is one of those great moments where God enters into the evil will of human beings and in his own compatible way manages to work his good and his will anyway. And so, chapter 11, verse 1, and the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. We're talking about Mesopotamia. We're talking about what came to be known as Babylonia, Babylon, modern-day Iraq. And they said one to the other, go to, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. The reason Moses would point that out is that we know from archaeology that up until a certain point, structures were made with just stone. They were finding stone, hewing stone. This is the first passage where we hear that they actually said, let's make brick. Let's actually design blocks of stone that we can use to make structures, buildings, walls, things that are really secure. So they said, let us make a brick and burn it thoroughly. And they had brick for stone, and they had slime that they used for mortar. And they said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven, and let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. Okay, there's a lot of stuff going on in that verse. First off, the phrase, let us build a tower, there's no real definite preposition there. We don't know if it's a tower unto heaven, toward heaven, pointed up at heaven. Archaeology, again, in this area of the world, has dug up a lot of these kind of towers. So we have even Herodotus wrote about some of the towers that are in the Middle East during his period. And they're really more like, when we think tower, we think like the Leaning Tower of Pisa or something, a round tower that stands up. But this was more like a multiple-leveled, multiple-tiered, almost pyramid-shaped thing. And they almost all that have been uncovered in the Middle East and in the area of Iraq, the old Mesopotamian towers, all had at the top of them some kind of dwelling for a god. They would have an idol inside it, and so it was a small temple at the very top of these towers. And so this phrase here, let us build us a tower that goes up into the heavens or reaches to the heavens or goes toward the heavens, probably meant a very tall building at the top of which they were going to go and worship the heavens. They may have been worshiping what would have been the seven known planets at the time. They may have been worshiping the stars. They were doing exactly what Paul describes in the early part of the book of Romans, where he says that the creatures, looking at the creation, began to worship the creation rather than the Creator. And this is always what false religion does. It looks at the creation and starts to celebrate the fact that the creation exists instead of celebrating the Creator who made all these things. So they're building a tower for two reasons. One is that it is toward or up to the heavens. It is designed for religious worship, but it's genuinely not godly worship. It's some form of idol worship going on here. And their reason for doing it is, let us make us a name. So you can see the intrinsic ego in it. It's all about us. Let's build us a reputation. Let's build us a name. And look at the last thing they said, so that we're not scattered abroad on the face of the earth. This was all about unifying. This is Nimrod saying, let's get a project going and unify everybody on the big project. And the big project is going to be a monument to us. And then we will go up on that monument that we have built and we will worship the creation, worship our idols, worship our gods. So it is a combination of human ego, evil desire to worship the creation, false worship, idol worship. You can see now why God would be slightly miffed. Good, one person enjoyed the phrase, slightly miffed. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower, which the children of men built. You do know, of course, that that's an anthropomorphism, yes? Anthropomorphism. Anthropos, man. Anthropology, study of man. Anthropomorphism is when you speak of God as having human characteristics. If we say God's hands, the hand of God, well, if God is a spirit, it's likely he doesn't actually have hands quite the way we do. Or we speak of God's heart. That's an anthropomorphism. That's speaking of God in human ways in order to help humans understand what God's like. My point being that it says here that the Lord came down to see the city and the tower. But if God is in fact God, he's everywhere, and he knew what was happening. It's very much like Adam hearing God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. He became aware of God's presence, and then God says to him, Adam, where are you? Well, God had to have known where he was. But this is God being represented by human characteristics so that we have a better understanding of God's activity. And so the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of men built. And the Lord said, behold, the people is one. They're one unified group. They have one language. And they have all one language, and this they begin to do. They get together as a group. They all speak one language. And what do? Go chase after other gods and build a monument to themselves. By the way, has anything really changed in human beings? Very little has changed in all this time, has it? Most people who get the least little bit of religion in them feel it is necessary to raise money to build a monument, usually to themselves, and then put their name on it, right? The Jimmy Swaggart University. That exists. Pardon me? The Trump Tower. What a good example. Yes, yeah, so we build monuments to ourselves. That's just sort of human nature. The Lord said, the people are all one, they have one language, and this they begin to do, and now nothing will be restrained from them, which they have imagined to do, because everything that anybody could imagine, they could tell other people about, and they could all communicate, and they would all agree as a group, which means, since these human beings were all wicked and base and depraved, and every intention of their heart was only wickedness, then of course they're going to communicate that to each other, and they're all going to participate, power in numbers. And next thing you know, every evil thing they could think of, they would do. This was God's concern. And so nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. Go to, let us go down, and there we will confound their language, that they may not understand. It's just awful. That they may not understand one another's speech. If there's any word in that sentence you shouldn't mispronounce, it's understand. The irony is thick. Yes, ma'am.
When they say us, is he speaking of like the Holy Trinity? I don't know what he's...
From the beginning of the book of Genesis, God is spoken of in the plural. Let us make man in our image. Okay. The word Elohim is a plural word. El, the name of God that you see so frequently, even here, Babel. El is the name for God. Jesus on the cross, Eli, Eli, my God, why have you forsaken me? But Elohim is a plural word. And so, yes, from the very beginning of the book of Genesis, you see plurality to God. He speaks of himself in the plural. And so when you see in Genesis 1, in the beginning, God, Elohim, did these things and said, let us make man in our image. And then you start the Gospel of John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. You now understand what that plurality was, that the Word, the Logos, the speaking agency of God, the Son, was always with God the Father. And so John tells us that what happened in Genesis 1, when God spoke and things were, that it was actually Christ that was the speaking agency, and there was nothing made that was not made without him, all that language. And so, yes, that was the long answer to your question. The short answer is yes. But the long answer was God speaks of himself in the plural throughout Genesis as an indication that the Trinity is actively at work. Yeah. Good question.
Thank you.
No problem. Others, by the way, have brought me chocolate as a form of thanks. I just thought I'd point that out. Go to, let us go down, and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there upon the face of all the earth, and they left off the building of the city. So you can see God's intention at work. Ever since he made Adam and Eve, and he said, be fruitful, multiply, populate the earth. It was always his intention that mankind was going to genuinely subdue the earth, that there would be human beings all over the earth. And as long as they spoke one language and had one culture and one determination, a common mind and a common project to work on, they were all going to stay right there in the Middle East. And so God entered into their evil intention and their evil work and used it for his good and his purposes and scattered folks all over the planet. Therefore is the name of it called Babel, and there we're using the term for confusion, because the Lord did there confound or confuse the languages of all the earth. And from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth. And that's the whole of the story. To me, I would have liked it if Moses had taken the time to tell us more about that. This is a cataclysmic event in human history and development. This is the moment at which language, multiple languages, appeared on the planet. I'd like to know more about it. Did people walk around speaking the language they spoke until they found others that spoke the language? Or did he take little clusters of people and give them all one language and then they discovered they were... I want to know more about what happened there. But he doesn't tell us. He just keeps moving because, as I've said, the early part of Genesis moves really, really fast because Moses has a destination in mind. And so he tells us about the first several hundred, if not thousand years of human activity on planet Earth. And he says, God made some people, and they fell. And I don't have time to tell you much about that. They were wicked, and they developed, and then one killed the other. So God put him out, and there were some others, and there was a flood, and they died. And then there were some others, and Shem, Ham, Japheth, there's a curse, and then languages. And then finally he gets to the middle of chapter 11, and the whole book of Genesis, you're going to see it. The language up until now has been just rapid fire. Moses has just been saying, this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened. Just giving us this brief overview, this like bird's eye view flying over in a plane real quickly. Look, there goes human history. Bam, 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 bam. And then in the middle of chapter 11, Genesis now is just going to open up. And it slows down. The pace of the writing slows down. And he finally gets to what he's been trying to get to, which is Abraham. And you're going to hear about Abraham and the promise made to Abraham and the land of Abraham and the seed of Abraham. And you're going to see Abraham throughout the rest of the Bible. You get into the New Testament and start talking about faith, they go to Abraham. You start talking about Jesus dividing between Gentiles and Jews as children of Abraham. Jesus dealing with the Pharisees and saying, you're of your father the devil. They say, oh, we're children of Abraham. Abraham's going to come up through the whole rest of the Bible. And in fact, the new covenant is based on the Abrahamic covenant. And God is going to several places throughout his dealings with Israel, even when Israel is at their worst, say, well, because of the promise I made to Abraham, I'm not going to wipe you all out. Paul is going to say in Romans 11 that concerning the 10 northern nations that are cut off from their heritage, the wild olive branches are grafted in. And he says he's going to graft those natural branches in. And then he says, as concerning the gospel, they are enemies for your sakes, you Gentiles, so that you could be grafted in. It's touching the gospel. They are enemies. But as touching the election, they are beloved for the Father's sake. Right back to Abraham. And so Abraham is a key essential ingredient in understanding the Bible. If you don't get Abraham right, if you don't get the Abrahamic covenant right, if you don't get that right, you can't understand the whole rest of the history and development of biblical theology. So guess what we'll be talking about a lot for the next few weeks? Abraham. It's going to be a lot of Abraham and a lot of the Abrahamic covenant, the basis of all seedology. Now, there was a hand up a moment ago. Yes, ma'am.
I was going to ask about... makes a point of repeating face of all the earth. Is this at what point we'll see the rise of world culture? I mean, if we were to look at archaeological evidence, I know it's really difficult.
Yes.
With carbon dating. And
right. And that was my point, and I'm glad you grasped it and dragged us back to it, because we hear about the development of culture, especially through a leader like Nimrod, and later Nimrod worship develops and all of the Ishtar stuff that goes with that. But that there was a genuine culture developed there in Babylon, in Babel. And then God scatters that people group who have a culture all over the earth. And wherever they go, there's like instant culture. And there's instant language. Why? Well, the only explanation for that fact is what you read right here. That God took people who had a culture and then scattered them all over the earth. And they took their concepts of culture with them. And their language divided them, but then every place that they settled, there was instant cultural mores, social codes, conduct codes, art, communication, language, instantly. Well, it has to be because they all came from a central point.
And also the religions that give rise from those same people end up being of the same constructs where they're egotistical and...
Yeah, Nimrod worship is everywhere still. Yeah, because it comes out of Babylon and moves out from there. Which is why, again, it is very interesting. The first place where you see this kind of idolatry, we're going to build a tower to the heavens, all of that kind of stuff, is in Babylon. And you get to the end of the book of Revelation, and there's finally an angel saying, Babylon has fallen. So Babylon is very much the bookends of the Bible. Early in Genesis, Babel is the problem. At the end of Revelation, Babylon's fallen. And in between, you've got the true religion of God. You've got the religion of Yahweh. And through the whole rest of the world, you have religions that can all trace their heritage back to Babel. Back to Babylon.
The Mayan religion, too, because from what you're describing...
The Mayan religion uses those same kind of ziggurat-type pyramids for towers, for worship. Yeah, absolutely. Yes?
All over the world, those little towers are everywhere.
Yeah. Isn't that something?
Even in China, the Buddhist temples are shaped like
that. And gee, why would that be? And they all, every one of those cultures has a flood legend.
I think Marco Polo runs.
Yeah. Almost like there was a commonality to them all. Yes, sir?
All the initial cultures, Egypt, China, Iraq, they all have the same kind of pantheistic deity system with the humanistic gods depicting natural things. They might have different names, but...
That's in European, Greek, and Roman mythology as well.
I mean,
it's...
Right? I mean, it stretches all through, and it's spread out from there.
Right.
But, you know, the basic concepts of, you know, like the Egyptians having their pyramids for, you know, burial, all their temple regalia, all these things through all these cultures throughout the initial phase, at least, of religious ritual and everything. Everything is all the same. It might have different names.
There's an amazing continuity to it, isn't there?
Which is why, I mean, when later on, when the Greeks and Romans had their, you know,
mythological
qualities.
If you need any other words, just let me know.
It was a situation where they were already in tune with each other.
Exactly
And the Egyptians were in tune with each other, and all these cultures have always been in tune with each other because. There's the commonality of all this false religion that ties them together, even though there is the division of language.
And the division of language would naturally also create local custom. You go to a Church of Christ in Tennessee and a Church of Christ in Kentucky, you're going to find differences, even though they're both Churches of Christ, and those are just little cultural differences from a few hundred miles. You can imagine if you take people with a common source, common root, common belief system, and then scatter them out around the world, over time there's going to be the addition of new traditions, new ideas, new philosophies, but they're all going to have that common root. And the further you dig back into the history of mankind, the more of that commonality keeps coming out. And it continues to say, the Bible account is how we got here. And again, there's no way to take God and the Bible out of the equation and make any sense of what we see in human history. We are then at chapter 11, verse 10. And these are the generations of Shem. This is very important. He's already told us once about the generations of Shem. Now he returns to this specifically so that he can trace Shem, the Shemites, from which we get the word Semite. If you hear about anti-Semitism, that is a version of this word, descendants of Shem, the Shemites. Now, he's going to give us the lineage of Shem so that he can connect it to Abraham. Why is that important? Because Abraham is going to be given a promise of land that belongs, after the division of people, to the Canaanites. The Canaanites, not Canaanites, Canaanites. The Canaanites, the descendants of Canaan, are the people who are under the curse because they had seen Noah in his nakedness and not treated him properly, and some shame came of that to the point where Noah cursed Canaan and his descendants. And so as a result, these people have a land, but it's a rich, fertile land, and it's a good land, and then Shem, the blessed line, has a descendant, Abraham, and Abraham is going to be told that he gets the land that the Canaanites have. And that fight is still going on today, as the descendants of Canaan are still over there saying, no, this is our land. And the descendants of Shem are still over there saying, no, this is our land. Again, you can't make sense of what's going on in history or even in our modern political climate if you don't understand the Bible. So these are the generations of Shem. Shem was 100 years old, and he begat Arphaxad 2 years after the flood. And Shem lived after he begat Arphaxad 500 years, and he begat sons and daughters. The first thing you should notice there is that ages of human beings are now dropping dramatically. Before the flood, we were into 800, 900 years per person. God said before the flood that the age of a human being was going to be 120 years. Now the flood comes, something so dramatic has happened to the atmosphere and the physicality of the earth that men's ages are cut in half right away. We're down to 500 years. And from this point forward, we're going to see lifespan just keep getting shorter and shorter and shorter until now in our own day, we're promised 70. You get your 70 years. And so something cataclysmic has changed in the atmosphere of the earth and in our capability, our ability as human beings to live as long as we used to. We're being continually corrupted more and more with each successive generation, and lifespan is proving that. Shem lived after he begat Arphaxad 500 years, and he begat sons and daughters, and Arphaxad lived 530 years and begat Salah. And Arphaxad lived after he begat Salah 403 years, and he begat sons and daughters. And Salah lived 30 years and begat Eber. And Salah lived after he begat Eber 403 years and begat sons and daughters. And Eber lived 430 years and begat Peleg. And Eber lived after he begat Peleg 430 years and he begat sons and daughters. And Peleg lived 30 years and begat Reu. And Peleg lived after he begat Reu 209 years and begat sons and daughters. See, the age is going down. We're now into 200s. Went from 500s down into 200s now. Reu lived 230 years. He begat Serug. And Reu lived after he begat Serug 207 years and begat sons and daughters. And Serug lived 30 years and begat Nahor. And Serug lived after he begat Nahor for 200 years and begat sons and daughters. And Nahor lived 9 and 20 years and begat Terah. And Nahor lived after he begat Terah 119 years and begat sons and daughters. Now we're down into the hundreds. And Terah lived 70 years and begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And this is where our history sort of begins. Now these are the generations of Terah. Terah begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran begat Lot. And Haran died before his father Terah in the land of his nativity, which is Ur of the Chaldees. Chaldees, Chaldean, the area of Iraq. Another word for that Mesopotamian area. The second captivity that the Israelites are going to go into, they're going to go into Assyria, which takes them right into that ancient area of Mesopotamia. After that, into Babylon. And then Babylon is going to be overrun by the Persians, which is modern-day Iran. And once the Persians overrun it, they come back into their own land, but then they're overrun by Grecians and then Romans. So finally you see the Western European influence coming into the Middle East. Up until then, all of the influence that's happening in Israel and in the land of Canaan and on all these early generations, all of the influence is Chaldean influence. So we have to think in terms of Chaldean calendars and Chaldean language, Chaldean culture. All of that's influencing all of this early human history. So that takes us to verse 30. No, it doesn't. It takes us to verse 29. And Abram and Nahor took them wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife was Milcah, the daughter of Haran, which means he married his cousin, and the father of Milcah, and the father of Iscah. And Sarai was barren, she had no child. And Terah took Abram his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his son's son, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife. And they went forth with them from Ur of the Chaldees, to go into the land of Canaan. And they came as far as Haran, and they dwelt there. And the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. Chapter 12 begins then with, Now the Lord had said unto Abram, Get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, into a land which I will show thee. So now Moses is pulling back that curtain and saying, okay, why this trip? Why in the world would Abram and his father and everybody else decide that they're going to go into the land of Canaan? There's a promise behind it. The Lord said unto Abram, get out from your country, Ur of the Chaldees, and from your kindred and from your father's house unto a land that I will show you. Chapter 12, verse 2, underline it in your Bible if you haven't already. Put an asterisk by it, put a big star on it, highlight it in yellow. Do something, because this is the first promise that begins to constitute the Abrahamic covenant. Chapter 12, verse 2 says, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless you, I will curse him that curses you, and in you shall all the families of the earth be blessed. The first telling of what's going to constitute the Abrahamic covenant. Now, those promises are going to be repeated several times over the course of the next couple of chapters. And then they're going to be repeated verbatim to his son, Isaac. And then they're going to be repeated verbatim unto Jacob, whose name is going to be changed to Israel. And then Israel is going to pass those promises on to Joseph, his favorite son's son, is going to get the physical promise. So we're going to get into all that. You can actually trace the Abrahamic covenant as it travels through the book of Genesis and then into the history of the Old Testament. And this is that word that I've used so frequently and the title of a book I'll probably never actually sit down and write, but I'm determined to if I ever get a moment to breathe. Seedology. We have to understand this idea of seed. God has promised now that through Abraham's seed, through his lineage, through his descendants, all the families of the earth are going to be blessed. That's quite a promise. Especially if you're talking about a guy in Ur of the Chaldees, who the extra-biblical books have told us his father was an idol maker for a living. And so it's not like Abram was a God-fearer or even a seeker-sensitive guy. It's not like he was out there looking for God. It's not like he wanted God to accept him. He didn't make any kind of decision for Christ. He didn't do anything of a religious nature other than wrong things. Worshipping idols, chasing after false gods. Making them, building false idols. And yet, God says to Abram, of all the people on planet Earth, he says to Abram, from you I am going to make a great people. And through your seed, I'm going to bless all the families of the earth. And you read nothing in any part of the Bible anywhere that says, and he did it because Abram was such a good guy, at least in Noah's case. It said Noah was upright. And at least in the case of Enoch, he walked and talked with God. It was not because God took him. In Abram's case, you find none of that. All you find is that God came to Abram and said, you're mine. And through you, I'm going to do really magnificent stuff. In fact, through you, I'm going to send the Redeemer. Through you, the Christ is coming. Through your direct line and lineage. Which is why when you get to the early parts of Matthew and Luke, they start right out with genealogies. And they trace him right back through David, back to Abram, to prove that the seed exists in history, that the lineage, the genealogy exists in history to prove that Jesus was the fulfillment, the culmination of the Abrahamic promise. And yet God made it to Abraham for no reason anybody in this room or anybody in history has ever been able to decipher or point to or conclude and say, well, there it is, there's the proof. That's why it was Abram, because he was a good dancer and fun at parties. There was just no explanation. Why Abram? Don't you shake your head at me. I'm just seeing if you're still with me. I get this from Shane. You were doing fine, Jim, and then you got to do fun at parties. There's nothing. Okay, what's my point? Because I am making a point. I do have one.
God chose Abraham. It wasn't his first.
God chose Abraham. Yeah, it's the same God all the way through the Bible, picking and choosing, doing whatever he wants to do among whatever people he wants to do it among, whether it's scattering them according to the languages he chooses to give them, which, by the way, if he's assigning languages to each individual, then he's determining what the people groups are. He's determining which people belong to which group and where they're going to go. And now he says to one guy, hey, through you, everybody gets a blessing. But it'll be through you. Now, there is a very physical aspect to this promise, and there is a very spiritual aspect to this promise. Both of those aspects are true and genuine. And this is where there's a lot of confusion where the Abrahamic covenant is concerned. The physical aspect of this covenant is, I'm going to give you the land of Canaan. That's very physical. That's very earthly. That's one you can check. That's when you can go say, oh, there's the land right there. It's this land we're talking about here. Later, he's going to bring him into Canaan and say, walk the length and the breadth of this land, every place the sole of your foot touches and every place you can see. Takes him up on a hilltop, on a mountain, and says, now look out over the land. Everywhere your eye can see, I'm giving that land to you and your descendants. The seed again. You and your descendants get this land. It's very physical. Through you, all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed. It's exceptionally spiritual. That is a very spiritual promise. All the nations of the earth are going to receive a blessing from God as a result of what I'm going to do through you. Notice, by the way, there are no conditions placed on this. Notice God has not yet said, I'll do all this if you will. It doesn't exist. Yeah, if you would choose me, if you would pick me and make me your God. You don't see any of that language. You find no conditions at all. Instead, God shows up and says, I'm God, you're mine. And now through you, I'm going to do these things. I'm going to do something very physical among your physical seed. And I'm going to do something very spiritual through your spiritual seed. And so you're going to see in the New Testament language of the fulfillment of the spiritual aspects of the Abrahamic covenant. And you're going to read that everybody who has faith in Christ is the spiritual seed of Abraham. Great, we get that, the spiritual aspect of that promise. The place where the controversy has developed through all the years is, well, then what about the physical aspects of that promise? The land promise. Have those land promises been done away with? Are the land promises still good? Did one part of the Abrahamic covenant go away and the other part continue? Or are the land promises meant to be spiritual? Do we spiritualize the land promises? Or should they remain physical? I insist that they remain physical. They're physical promises to begin with. And the place where most people don't get it right, where the Abrahamic covenant is concerned, is that they don't understand that the physical and the spiritual aspects of that promise are divided. And that when Jacob, whose name is changed to Israel, puts his right hand on the head of Joseph's son Ephraim and gives him the birthright and then says that rulership will not depart from Judah, but that through Judah will come Shiloh. From that point forward, the spiritual aspect of the promise and the genealogies that go with it go toward Judah, and the physical aspect of the promise all belongs to Ephraim. And so until you see Ephraim fulfill that portion of the promise, you haven't seen that promise fulfilled. Which means, by the way, that to this very day, when we see Jews, historic Jews, returning to Israel, oftentimes the sensationalists get very excited and write books and sell lots of them that say, Jews are coming to Israel. It's the fulfillment of the Abrahamic promise. I'm one of the guys over on the sideline going, no, it's not. No, settle down. Don't read that book. Because until the descendants of the northern kingdom, the Ephraimites, are returned to that land, you can't say the promise has been fulfilled. That promise is simply not fulfilled in any genuine way until the northern tribes return. Of course, then again, you've got Romans 11, where Paul says that the cut-off branches are going to be grafted back in, and so all Israel will be saved. To me, that's very in keeping with the promise that the cut-off branches, the northern tribes, are going to be returned to the covenant that was always theirs, and so they will get everything they've ever been promised. Has that happened yet? No, absolutely not. Is God restricted or restrained by the fact that it hasn't happened yet? Not at all. Let me show you something. Turn to 1 Chronicles chapter 5. Let me biblically prove what I just said to you. If everything I just said about the Abrahamic covenant and the physical end of it and the spiritual end of it being divided when Jacob handed out the birthright promises before his death, if that's true, it would have been widely known among the Israelites and the Jews, and you would think that they would mention that somewhere. Well, they do. Chapter 5 of the book of Chronicles, and the Chronicles are exactly what it says. Kings and the Chronicles are all the stories of the history of Israel. And the Chronicles have a lot of begatting going on. There's a lot of, in the book of Numbers, lots of begatting, lots of generations, lots of genealogies, lots of tracing the genealogy. Why were the Israelites so determined to trace genealogies over and over again? You see it again in Matthew and Luke. Why all these endless genealogies? Well, it's tracing the seed. It's proving that God is keeping his word through the very people that he said he was going to keep his word through. So chapter 5 of 1 Chronicles says, "Now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel..." Jacob, who has his name changed to Israel, has 12 sons. Those 12 sons become the 12 progenitors of the 12 tribes of Israel. Reuben is the firstborn. Reuben should get the birthright. He is the firstborn. And so the sons of Reuben should get the land inheritance, the wealth of their father, all the physical promises. "Now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, for he was the firstborn, but for as much as he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given unto the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel." So the sons of Joseph have the birthright, which is the land inheritance, which is the physical inheritance. Everything that their dad owned on earth, birthright now goes to Ephraim, who got his right hand placed on his head. We'll read all that coming up. But look, "the birthright was given unto the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel, and the genealogy is not to be reckoned after the birthright." Did you follow that? That means the seed, the following of the seed that's leading to the spiritual promise, is no longer going to follow the birthright promise. The birthright promise has gone off into Ephraim, off into the northern kingdoms. But the genealogy leading to the seed is not going to be reckoned after the birthright. Instead, verse 2, "For Judah prevailed above his brethren, and of him came the chief ruler." But the birthright was Joseph's. And you're going to read about that as we continue through the book of Genesis, that that's precisely what happened when Israel was ready to die, and he hands out these promises, and he predicts what's going to become of his 12 sons. And in the course of that, first he has Joseph bring his two children in, Ephraim and Manasseh. Manasseh is the eldest. And so when Joseph brings them in before his father, he very wittingly, very purposefully, puts Manasseh, his eldest, at his father's right hand to get the birthright. And it says that old blind Israel, Jacob, crosses his arms, knowing what his son would do, and begins to put his hands on the two boys. And Joseph stops him and says, "No, not so, father, no. This is Manasseh, my oldest. Put your hand over here." And he says, "I know what I'm doing." And he gives the birthright to Ephraim, the youngest, and says, "Ephraim will prevail over his brethren." And from that point forward, as you watch the development of the northern 10 tribes, they become known as Ephraim. And the chief city is Mount Ephraim. Israel, collectively the northern tribe, travel under the name Ephraim because that is their chief tribe. So Ephraim, the northern tribes, have the birthright promise. And then as of the Assyrian captivity, they disappear into captivity, never to come back to the land of Canaan, and finally establish their own land, the land of Samaria, the northern kingdom area. And so they're out there scattered somewhere, known to history then as the lost tribes. And yet Jesus, when he sends out the 12, says, "Don't go into the way of the Gentiles, neither go into the way of the Samaritans, but go first to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." What stunning language! He's talking to people who are of the house of Judah, the southern kingdom, and he says, "Take the gospel of the kingdom to the house of Israel." Very important nomenclature. So in Jesus' time, they were findable, locatable. And what does he tell them? Go out and preach the kingdom to the house of Israel. So the house of Israel, the northern tribes, who have never come back to their property, who have never been reestablished in their own land, have the birthright promise. But the birthright is not to follow the genealogy, the seedology. The seed is continuing to Christ, so that Paul will write in the book of Galatians that the seed is Christ. So we know that the ultimate end of all of those genealogies and lineages is the appearance of Christ, the promise that was given to Abraham, that through his seed, Christ, all the families of the earth would be blessed. But you'll get your Abrahamic covenant theology confused if you don't understand that the physical promise and the spiritual promise are two different entities that take two different directions later. So when you get to the new covenant and you see the spiritual promise fulfilled, that doesn't mean everything's fulfilled. That means the spiritual promise is fulfilled. And I agree, yes, spiritual promise fulfilled in Christ, absolutely. But you don't find the physical promise, which took the birthright path, fulfilled yet. But you do find all this language that says it's gonna be. And so I'm a gonna be advocate. Get all that? Okay. Now the Lord had said unto Abram, get out of your country and out of your kindred from your father's house into a land that I will show you. That's the physical promise. I'm going to give you this land. That land promise is going to go to the northern kingdom. And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless you, and I will curse him that curses you, and in you shall all the families of the earth be blessed. So Abraham departed, as the Lord had spoken unto him, and Lot went with him, and Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. And Abram took Sarai his wife, and Lot his brother's son, and all their substance which they had gathered, and the souls which they had gotten in Haran, and they went forth to go into the land of Canaan, and into the land of Canaan they came. And Abram passed through the land unto the place of Shechem, unto the plain of Moreh, and the Canaanite was then in the land. And the Lord appeared unto Abram and said, unto your seed, your lineage, I will give this land. And there he built an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. And he removed from thence, and he went to a mountain in the east called Bethel, house of God. We'll get into all of that next week. I can't go by that verse without pointing out that once he had heard the promise from God, you're going to get this land, I'm going to give you this land, and you're going to have descendants, you're going to have seed. I have to point out to you that all this time, Sarah hasn't had any kids. And we're going to find out that another 10 years is going to pass, and she's going to be well beyond childbearing. And God is going to change Abram's name, which means exalted father, though he's got no kids yet, to Abraham, Abraham, father of multitudes. And actually, at one point, Abram decides to argue with God about it because he has no kids. And he seems to think that God is not aware of that fact. And he takes the time to point out, you know, you keep telling me about this seed and that through my seed, they get this land and all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed. And he finally says, all I've got is this servant. Is that who you mean? And God says, no, you and Sarah are going to have a kid. Really? She's past childbearing, I'm closing in on 100, and we're supposed to knock out a kid. There's that tender phrase. We're going to knock out a kid. Because God is one more time going to prove that the Abrahamic covenant has absolutely nothing to do with human will, determination, or flesh, or activity. And Abram's going to try to do it his own way. He's going to try to do it in the flesh. He's going to go in a tent with Sarah's handmaid, and they're going to produce a child who is to this very day a thorn in the side of Israel nationally. So that was a big mistake with long-lasting consequences. But once God gives him this promise, it says he then built an altar to God. Isn't that interesting that would come up again? Practically every chapter we've gotten to so far, somebody is building an altar to God, sacrificing to God, bringing sacrifice to God. Altar is where you kill, where you burn the best of what you have for God's glory. These sweet savor offerings that we keep seeing coming up again and again and again and again. There's something to that. Don't ignore the fact that every time God shows up in the Old Testament, people are bringing him sacrifice. People are coming and offering to him. People are building altars to him. The worship of God and sacrifice for God is a constant throughout the Bible. And even though I don't stand up here and stump for money, I'd be remiss if I didn't point out anything that consistent. That every time God shows up and blesses people, he expects a return, and they always bring it to him.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.